Historically, service providers have used a variety of practices to control unwanted behaviours. Richard Brogerman is senior practitioner in the Department of Human Services and has seen these kinds of restrictive practices used in the disability sector. At the end of this week, he's retiring from 30 years of service. He joined me for a chat about his work, the danger of having low expectations for people with disability and the resulting boredom that people who receive support and care can live with. He started off by explaining what restrictive practices are.
Well, restrictive practices are devices, interventions, etc., which are really about controlling behaviour. For example, there are a number of them. We have mechanical restraint, as where you use a belt or a cuff, a straitjacket in the old days. Physical restraint is where you use your body to stop people from doing things that you don't want them to do, grabbing them. Chemical restraint is where you use a drug to basically zonk people out and to stop their behaviour. Seclusion, where we basically lock somebody in their room. And environmental restraint, where basically we change the environment. The one that's a big ticket item in disability services is putting a lock on the refrigerator. And the thing that we have to remember with restrictive practices is we should only use them in occasions where the person's behaviour is putting themselves or other people at risk.
It's interesting to reflect on the use of these practices throughout history. What was the rationale behind using these kinds of practices?
Okay, well, the rationale was really just to stop people from doing these things. And if we went back to, say, 1960, we would have found people with intellectual disabilities living in the back wards of Hillcrest and Glenside Hospital in terrible conditions and locked up, drugged up, often in straitjackets. And it was interesting, if this happened to you or I at that time, you know, there would have been a song and dance. You know, we would have been able to say that we'd been falsely imprisoned or that we'd been subject to battery. And those rights that we have as citizens actually always applied to people with disabilities, but they were never really recognised and enforced. And I think it was because we sort of assumed that there was us, the people that were worthy of, you know, having these rights, and then others. And once you think of people as others, then you can say the rights that we have don't apply to them.
And also this thought process of we know what's best for them. You know, they don't have a sense of control over their lives.
Correct, yes. And having control over your life is really important. I mean, as I get older, the one thing that I really value is my ability to make decisions for myself. So when my beloved is giving me instructions or advice, I say to her, "Dear, it's Australia." In other words, in Australia, we've got rights. We can do what we want to do. We can make our own decisions. And again, that's something that was denied people with disabilities.
Another disturbing form of restrictive practice was the sterilisation of women with disability.
Correct, yes. So again, if a doctor were to want to sterilise any person, or there was a thought that the person should be sterilised, the first thing is that they have to consent to it. And most women wouldn't consent unless there was some medical reason for doing it. But 40 to 45 years ago, probably even longer, and hope not too recently, many women were sterilised, often not without their consent, not only without their consent, but often without even their knowledge of what was happening to them. You know, you're going to have an operation, you'll wake up and you'll feel a little bit sore. And we'd have a cohort of women in South Australia aged 55 to 85 who would have been sterilised. And I often think if one of your listeners is a smart, young, upwardly mobile lawyer, it'd be a good cause for a class action.
And the practice of sterilising women, it has roots in a lack of awareness of understanding one's disability, but also there's a sexism there as well.
Yes, I believe so. And it was mainly women who were sterilised. There were men who were sterilised, but very, very few compared to women. And, I mean, this was done for some really crazy reasons. We used to have, at the beginning of the 20th century, the eugenics movement, and it had as its core that if we were to stop people with disabilities from having children, we'd raise the quality of the community generally. it was a spurious theory, but around the world it saw many, who knows, thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people sterilised.
And I think the frustrating thing for parents and caregivers of these people is that they themselves weren't educated on the rights of someone with a disability and,
yes,
you know, their power.
Yes. There's a whole array of things at work here. Families are concerned about their daughter being raped because many of these young women are very vulnerable. And in the past, we've had workers who've come into this field specifically so that they can carry out various crimes on people with disabilities. So when I was responsible for running Strathmont, there was a guy who got into our system, and he was there because he wanted to just feel what it was like to punch people up. And he was eventually prosecuted and jailed. And we've had people equally who have been sexual predators. And, of course, this is an ideal population because they can't basically report what's occurred. And so families have had their children sterilised because they think it's, you know, they don't want their child to have children. There are other issues as well about dealing with periods. You know, they just think, my daughter can't deal with this, therefore it's better to have her sterilised. And it's been interesting. One of the things that we did was to try to educate and support families. And many families now wouldn't choose sterilisation as an option. But even if they wanted their daughter sterilised, they would find very quickly that there'd be very few doctors willing to do it. And the only legal way that it can occur is that there is an application made to the South Australian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, and they ask a lot of questions before they would just allow sterilisation to occur.
Thank goodness for that.
Mm.
And also, sterilisation, it denies these women a rite of passage.
Yes.
For some of us who have a menstrual cycle, it's regarded as something that's a bit, yes, annoying, that comes by each month. But for women who already feel different or are treated differently, to have something taken away from you that you share with other women would be, yes, so humiliating.
Yes. And of course, having a sterilisation is not without ongoing medical risks as well. It's another way of separating people with disabilities from their peers, from other young women and other women. I think one of the things that's occurred recently is that we're more aware of those issues of separation, and we try not to have systems where those sorts of things occur, including allowing people, women with disabilities, to be sterilised.
What's changed in regards to restrictive practices?
Okay. Well, a lot of things have changed. We started to see that there was a need for changes probably two decades ago. And we realised that in many instances, some of the things that we were doing were more for our benefit than for the benefit of the individual. And so we set up some distance things. When I say we, incidentally, I used to be the CEO of the Intellectual Disability Services Council. We ran Strathmont Centre. So one of the things that might occur, there's a young man, he's got very, very difficult behaviours, and the local manager wants to give him some medication that will basically knock him out. And the alternative is that we perhaps have some additional staff to support this young man. And so we've got a real vested interest because, you know, the minister's always yelling at us about our budget to zonk him out with some drugs. So we started a process whereby we said those decisions couldn't be made at this level. They had to be made somewhere separately in the organisation. And since then, there's been an awareness of the rights of people with disabilities. That was particularly enforced with the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. It didn't confer new rights. It basically said people with disabilities should have the same rights as other people in the community. So we have a right not to be locked in our room. We have a right not to be mechanically restrained. People with disabilities have the same rights. Now, sometimes to keep them or other people safe, we need to do those things. But what we then need to do is to ensure that there's some process of law which gives us the authority to be able to do that. Somebody's taking a look at what we want to do and saying, yes, it's reasonable to do that in those circumstances, and you have authority to do that. Because otherwise what occurs is the lines of where these things are used get blurred. So, for example, Environmental restraint is where, for example, we might put a lock on the refrigerator. We have people who will unfortunately get into the freezer and eat the frozen chicken, and that puts themselves at great risk. So we might contemplate putting a lock on the refrigerator in those circumstances. However, I've seen situations where a young man goes into the fridge and every third time he spills milk on the floor, and the staff have said, we need to put a lock on the refrigerator to stop him from spilling the milk. That's not a legitimate reason to use a restrictive practice. We should only use them when the person's behaviour puts themselves or other people at risk, not for our convenience.
And in that case with the young man with the milk, it seems to be something like helping him, supporting him to Correct. Be able to learn not to spill the milk.
You know, you're quite right. And even for the people who eat the frozen chicken, one of the things that we need to do is to see whether we can help them learn other ways of coping with those sorts of situations. And so what we've been doing is we've been regulating this. Now, the regulating is basically saying, if we're going to do these things, we need to ensure that there's some legal process that enables us to do it. I go back to Magna Carta. No free man, didn't say woman at the time, but now, of course, women can be seized or imprisoned without due process of law. So no one can be deprived of their liberties and their freedoms without some process of law. And in South Australia, that process is the South Australian Civil Administrative Tribunal. And so that regulates it to make sure that we've got a legitimate reason to do it. However, we've taken another step and we've said, maybe we can actually find ways in which we don't have to use these practices. So, for example, a young man, he's bashing his head. And when we only have a restricted practice mindset, what we do is we stop him bashing his head. When we use a sort of an approach which is about trying to understand what the behaviour's about, we then ask the questions, has he got some physical ailment or some pain or a mental illness that's causing this? And in one terrible circumstance, a young man had a terrible toothache and he was bashing his head to sort of mask the pain of his toothache. And so we restrict him, we stop him from doing that. And the only strategy that he's got to deal with his toothache, we take away from him. Now, he can't tell us he's got a toothache. And this takes more care and more attention. We have to have dentists and doctors who are really good at examining this stuff. The other thing is that sometimes these behaviours have got other root causes. You know, the person gets something from using the behaviour. So, you know, if I grab you and you say, stop that, Richard, and I grab you and you say, Richard, I told you not to do that. What I might be hearing is, Richard, you know, every time I grab Lisa, she's going to say my name. Well, I'll keep doing it. And we might find some way, well, Richard's obviously wanting some, you know, recognition. How can we give him some recognition for things that are more socially acceptable? So you might want me to do this little task. And you then say, well done, Richard. Great work, Richard. And I'm getting that recognition. And then if I do grab you, you don't give me any feedback. And over time, I realise I get the feedback for doing these things. So I have to say, if behaviour support was as easy as that, we wouldn't have any problems. Often trying to determine what the behaviour is about for an individual can be a time-consuming process. When we think we know what it's about, we develop a theory, and then we say, and what's some way in which we can deal with that? And we try that, and if it works, great. If we don't try it, we try again, because the day we stop, we're committed to locking people up.
And that brings up another really important point. By using restrictive measures, and that is so often our first response, where we're at the risk of not allowing people to exercise their rights to live with free agency.
Yes, you're quite right. And look, equally, we can't let people do dangerous things. But if we can give them the skills to be able to deal with the things that are important to them and have that free agency, I call it personal sovereignty, but free agency is a really good term, you know, we'll do much better. You know, I remember a young woman, Caroline, and we met her in 1998. She was in an adolescent mental health unit. We were told that she would be locked up for the rest of her life. And our people agreed to take her on. the mental health services were going to give us a big wad of money to do that, and they never did. Not that I'm bitter and twisted. And I just had to get that in. And we then had a look at what was this behaviour about, because, you know, her behaviour was dangerous. She'd actually injured people. And what we found was that there are a number of things. One of them was if she was agitated, she became dangerous. And one of the things that made her agitated was open-ended questions. So what would you like to do today? She'd think, I could do this, I could do that, I could da-da-da-da-da-da-da, boom, and then there'd be some outburst. And so the people who worked with her had to all be on the same page and ask her, basically give her two or three choices, and she could cope with it. The really good thing about Caroline is that she didn't want this behaviour, and she was really committed to getting rid of it. And we also gave her some strategies to deal with other stress things so that she could withdraw and play some music and do other things. And this is now, what, 15 years ago, I met the woman who supported her about 4 years ago and asked after Caroline, and I was told she was working in a supermarket, she was buying her own flat, and she'd written to our department and said, thanks for your help, I don't need any more help. And I have to say, if positive behaviour support was always as productive as that, it'd be fantastic. But sometimes just the small steps that people can make in being able to keep their behaviour under control and make their own decisions is a huge step. And I make the point, the day we give up on people, we're committed to locking them up for life.
And it just goes to show the power of not having low expectations for
Correct.
People.
Yes, yes. And look, we've had low expectations, particularly people with cognitive disabilities. And this has started with their mums and dads often. And it started, you know, when they first had heard the news from a doctor. And the doctor said, your son's got Down syndrome. He's going to be mentally retarded, would probably be the language they would have used. We suggest you put him in an institution and have some other children forget about him. And some families did that. Most families didn't. They said, you know, this is my son, he's living with us. This is my daughter, she's going to stay in our family. But they were then presented with low expectations. Your son will be a burden. Your son will never achieve this. And then the resources to enable their son to do those things weren't there. So we didn't actually educate many people with intellectual disabilities and really well until 20 to 30 years ago. And you don't teach them, they don't learn, your low expectations are fulfilled. And so families have gone through their lives not having these expectations. It's been really interesting. One of the organisations that's done really well has been the Down Syndrome Association. They had programs where they intervened and gave people skills. And there are now people with Down syndrome who are doing things that we just wouldn't have thought possible. There's a young man, I'll call him Bill. He works for a local council. He's worked there for 25 years now. He's an important part of their organisation. Having a job has enabled him to buy a unit in a little cul-de-sac where there's some older people living. And it's a little group that look after each other. He does some of the, you know, taking out of the bins for people who are not that mobile. And they give him a bit of help with, you know, like, this is a bill from so-and-so and you need to pay it. And he's involved in the social activities of the organisation he works for. So this is about inclusion. And I can remember vividly talking about this to one family, and she's crying. And I thought, well, what have I done? And when I talked to her, she said, I never thought my daughter could do anything. And then I hadn't seen her for a while. She'd been in a service, and she'd actually learnt two languages. And when I saw this, I'd seen how I'd restricted her. Now, the good thing about the NDIS, it's going to, I think, galvanise families to say, my son's got a disability, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have the capacity to do lots of things. And I want that support to enable him to do those things. And I think, you know, in the past with those low expectations, your son goes into a group home and you're really grateful that he's there. And when they treat him poorly, you don't make a song and dance because you're grateful and you don't want to rock the boat. And it's really important that families come through with a view about rocking boats, because in our service systems, unfortunately, there are some organisations that are very good. There are some that are very average.
What percentage of people who have or are receiving support and care, what do you think the chances of them having been bored at some stage in their lives?
Well, it's a good question. And the percentage I don't know, but I know there's a... I've seen it. I mean, I'll give you the example of my grandson. He just started working in this sector recently. And so keen as mustard first day. And of course, between 7 and 8 o'clock, there's a flurry of activity, getting people up, toileting, dressing, showering, breakfast, dishes. And then, you know, he's there now. What do we do next? Well, have a seat, mate. We watch television until 11 o'clock. And then we'll start thinking about where we have for lunch. And then after lunch, we'll watch television. So people are sitting around doing nothing. And people don't ask them, what would you like to do? People don't say to them, would you like to learn how to do these things? Or what are the things that you would like to learn? What are the new skills that you would like? So we see people bored, not learning new skills, dependent on other people, not doing the things that they want to do. And when their behaviour gets a bit stroppy, we zap them with restrictive practices. And it's been very interesting. I've been using what I've called the Sophie's Choice analogy. So I've been talking to staff and I give them this choice, Sophie's Choice about the woman in the concentration camp. She has to choose between which of her daughters is going to live and which is going to die. So the Sophie's Choice I give the staff when I'm training them is you've got two choices. The first choice, 3 times a year you're going to slap across the face. It'll sting, it won't leave any marks and it won't do any permanent damage. The other choice is that every day of the year you'll be bored out of your brain. You won't be exercising any decision making. You'll be dependent on other people. You'll not be learning new skills and you won't be doing anything that you want to do. Which do you choose? Now, so far, the score is 752, take the slaps. 3 people have said they'd go with the boring life. And 1 person, it was obviously so difficult, I said, don't bother about doing it. Now, it's very interesting. In our sector, what are we reporting? We're reporting the slaps. And it's important that they get reported. But what I think is really important is that we report that these people are living really, basically, crap lives because organisations are not doing the things that they could do to make those lives better. And the interesting thing that I found is that it's not only the people that we're serving who become disabled, the staff themselves become disabled, in my view. You know, you're looking forward to 5 o'clock, you hate this, it's boring, you're sitting around watching television. And then you see staff who are going the extra distance and doing the really good things. And their days fly through. And at the end of the day, they've taught new skills and accomplished things. And they've made a person's life happier. And it's such a difference. And at the present time, if you're doing that really poor support or you're doing the really good support, you get paid an equal amount of money from the government.
You're obviously very passionate about this subject.
Yes.
What inspired that? Where did this come from?
Well, I'm going to get all sort of emotional here. But my mum and dad worked in this field. So I was exposed to people with intellectual disabilities when I was pretty young. They often used to have children come and stay at our house. And from there, I got into working in this area through the Autistic Children's Association, as it then was. I was involved in their board, and then I was the president for a while. And then I worked in the Intellectual Disability Services Council. I was appointed when I was, I think, 39 as the CEO, an upwardly mobile young bureaucrat, and I got into this field. And I spent the next 30 years learning about what was important to people with intellectual disabilities and their families. And it has been interesting, you know. What I saw was people with intellectual disability displaying grace, humility, forgiveness, qualities that I'd really want in myself, and families displaying resilience, having a passion for their son or daughter, keeping a vision for their son or daughter aloft, even though they're often told by professionals and doctors and organisations, your son's disabled. And there are some families that say, no, he's going to accomplish this. That man, Bill, that I told you about, who accomplished so much, that was his mum. The vision that she had for him. She was never going to have him separated from the community in terms of, you know, going to a special school or being involved in a special service. He was a part of the community and always was. And, you know, the NDIS gives us some opportunities to ensure that those sorts of things occur. So, you know, I've been rethinking, what's the role of people with intellectual disabilities in our community? It's teacher. You know, they teach us those more important skills in life, which are about how we relate to people, how we forgive people, how we act with grace and humility. And, you know, it was a massive learning process for me and one that I greatly valued.
Because it's not something that all children and young people grow up knowing about.
No. And look, I have to say, if I hadn't gone to the Intellectual Disability Service Council, if I'd gone to, say, be the deputy CEO of the Royal Adelaide Hospital, who knows where I might have wound up in the system. But when I got here, I basically stayed in that field. And, you know, I had sort of 4,000 or 5,000 teachers, and they're the key lessons that I learned. And, you know, there are little things that just stand out. I was at a conference once, and we had included some people with disabilities. And this one guy was going to talk at 3 o'clock. And, of course, we had all the motor mouths, you know, going on and on and on. It looks like he's going to be 3:30. And he got up and he said, "I've got to go. I sell papers for the news. They depend on me." And off he went. And I thought, oh, you know, there are so many things to learn there. You know, like he was being treated like what he was going to do was unimportant. But it was important. It was important to him. It was important to the news that their newspapers get sold. And so, you know, I've had sort of the privilege of having probably 5,000 of those little experiences, each of which teaches you something about humanity.
And it means that you keep on being inspired as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope to be. I retire from my job on the 30th of June, but I'll find some way of keeping involved in the sector. And what I'm really keen to see is that the NDIS delivers what it promises. And there are some key things that we have to make sure that we continue. In South Australia, we've had a group called the Community Visitors. Maurice Corcoran is the principal community visitor. He's a great guy. And the community visitors go into houses and they see where that boring stuff is happening and when those restrictive practices that haven't been authorised are happening. And they can report those and Maurice takes them up with the organisation. Now, we need to have something like that, you know, something that's monitoring our services, because otherwise we get to a sort of an equilibrium point where nothing bad happens because bad triggers police, all sorts of things. But unfortunately, nothing good happens. And what's happened in the past is that when nothing good happens, no one cares about it or knows about it.
You're officially retiring. What's your message to people who are coming through the sector who are starting out?
Well, I'd say make sure you meet lots of people with disabilities. Don't sit in ivory towers and make decisions about people that you've never met. I've got a couple of stories there, but it's a bit late now to tell them, of people who've been sitting in ivory towers making decisions. And in fact, the NDIS was really designed for people with physical disabilities. And to the great credit of the National Disability Insurance Agency, they are learning and they've established an intellectual disability reference group to make sure that their services are relevant to people with disabilities. So meet people, engage with them, find out their stories, find out the things that they can teach you. You know, like, it's not all one way. You know, just because you've got a university degree doesn't mean you can't learn lots of things from a person with a disability. And in many instances, those higher order qualities that we should all try to aspire to.
Richard Bruggeman, Senior Practitioner in the Department of Human Services. He's retiring at the end of this week after 30-plus years of service in the disability sector. Congratulations on your retirement, Richard, and thank you for your life's work from all of us here at Small Change and SACOS.